Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keane, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. If you have a tour duty at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, that means you have a certain caste. It's called freshwater or tidal economics. And it goes really interesting theories down there. The late Marvin Goodfriend was one of the academics that led so much of that. And you get to the Fed Richmond with all of its history, its heritage. You can do that out of Washington and Lee University, which is, it's a short drive.
Yep.
You get the carriage,
Lexington, Virginia.
The two-horse carriage, and
yep.
you go up there. And, of course, you do it with some hard-nosed University of Chicago economics. Stephen Stanley joins us now, right now with Santander. What was it like at the Richmond Fed? I've done so much work with them, including visiting and, their history. They used to write these, the Edgeworth box, 42 pages on the Edgeworth box. What was it like walking in to the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond out of Washington, Lee in Chicago?
Well, first of all, I have to say, I feel like I'm on This Is Your Life. This is a great trip down memory lane. But yeah, it was great. It was a fantastic place to start my career. Marvin was one of my mentors, and I learned so much. It was fantastic.
Is their underlying real economy theory valid, or is there something to the saltwater economics of the Charles River?
Well, I think, so back in the day, going back decades, the Richmond Fed was definitely one of the monetarist banks, and that, of course, the theories there have evolved, but I certainly think that the framework that I got has helped me a lot, so...
Does the Fed have a framework now? I don't, if it's neo-monetarist, neo-Keynesian, neo-Stanley, I don't care. But all of our, Paul and I get mail on this every, Lisa gets mail on this. The bottom line is there a plan? Is there a framework?
Well, I think the closest thing they have to that would be the board staff and their models, which, broadly speaking, I would say are kind of, as you say, neo-Keynesian. I think the Phillips curve gets a lot of weight at the Fed, even though publicly the Fed will kind of distance itself from that. That has always been a lodestar for the Fed. But I think there's also a lot of pragmatism now, which, is good and bad. I think... It's good that people are flexible, but at the same time, it sometimes does feel like there isn't really a strong framework from which to through which to interpret the data.
So, how do you think the Fed is interpreting that data these days? I mean, they say they're data dependent, and the data, particularly the inflation data, we'll obviously get the PCE on Friday, but it's kind of reared its head a little bit more over the last few months. Do you think it's enough for the Fed to just say, I think we're just going to sit on the sidelines and see what happens?
Well, here's how I would frame it up. So for about 18 months, roughly the end of last year, you heard Chairman Powell over and over again saying, we think we're going to need to see a period of subpar growth, some slackening in the labor market, if we're going to get inflation where we want it, down to 2% on a sustainable basis. And then you had that period in the second half of last year when growth was really strong, but the inflation numbers were still coming down. And I think they got a little bit enamored by that. And all of a sudden, in January, you heard Powell essentially say, we think maybe we can have our cake and eat it too here. We think the economy can just rip along and inflation is magically going to make its way to 2%. And I think the data so far this year has been a bit of a slap in the face to that optimism.
Are you concerned that this economy, I mean, it seems like, again, I took a couple of business classes at University of Richmond. I feel like I'm, economics classes, I feel like I'm, I can state an opinion on economics. Is this soft landing? Have they landed this soft landing? Or do you think there's a risk that maybe it's going to be a little bit bumpier maybe?
Well, we've certainly made good progress on that front, but I don't think you can declare victory until inflation is actually back to 2%.
Now, what's the 2% number? When did that come about? I never heard about that until like a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And then people started talking about what's wrong with 2.5 or 3%?
So, you know, the in theory, price stability you would think would mean zero inflation.
Okay.
But there are two issues. One is there's you know, economists will tell you that the inflation data are biased. So the true price stability number is probably somewhere between 0.5% and 1%. And secondly, and more importantly, I think the Fed has been spooked over the last several cycles by getting captured in the zero bound, and they want to stay away from that as much as they can. And so a little higher inflation takes them further away from the zero bound on average.
Our theme the last 2 days has been the stimulus. How does it unwind? Rishir Sharma with a brilliant piece in the FT today, iconic at Morgan Stanley, and his work at the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, and just wonderful trying to figure out this mystery of the glide path of what I'm going to invent this word this morning. You could steal it, Steve. This de-stimulus. What's your framework for how many quarters we need to migrate out to de-stimulize from the pandemic?
Yeah, well, I think for me, it's at this point, it's not as much the pandemic anymore in the sense that the you know, I think there's still a lot of fiscal stimulus in the system, but the bulk of it is not coming from the pandemic programs. It's coming from the things that were passed afterward, the infrastructure.
Agreed. Blanchard has talked about the three levels of stimulus.
Yep.
So what's your timeline on this?
Well, I mean, these programs that we just ticked off have multi-year spending paths. So I think it's a while. I mean, what I would really like to see is I'd like to see some fiscal discipline. I mean, we're running $2 trillion a year budget deficits.
There we go. There's the Richmond kicking in.
That's it.
We needed we got to end the interview, but it's good. With the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Stephen Stanley with us. What we're going to do here, folks, is the usual blah, blah, blah about like where are we and what's housing inflation going to do and maybe what the international thing is. And then there's a memo that just stops you in your tracks. Terry Weissman with us right now. To say he's head of global currencies interest rate strategy at Macquarie barely describes decades of experience back to Fortress Schwartz at Bear Stearns a few years ago. I was stopped and I was thinking of David Folkerts Landau of Deutsche Bank the day after Putin invaded Ukraine. And here you are with a definitive piercing note. Let's repeat what we've already said. Wars are inflationary. Are we missing the forest from somewhere out there, the trees? Is all of this inflation we're talking about, maybe we had a war and a pandemic, but these wars are inflationary, full stop.
Yeah, this shouldn't be a mystery to most people, Tom. I think if you look at the history of inflations in the US and where we've had big spikes, it was during Korea, right? We had a demobilization after World War II and inflation fell, but when Korea started, we had a big inflation in the US. And then we had an inflation again in the intensification of the Vietnam War in the late 60s. And then we had an inflation again in 1973, which coincided with the Arab-Israeli War of the time. And we had an inflation again with the first Gulf War, right? And we had an inflation again with Russia and Ukraine. I mean, this is optically, you look at these charts and you look at what coincides with these wars. It is these spikes in inflation. You have to conclude that there's something to do with the idea that wars cause inflation. I think you can talk about what the channels are, but supply side disruptions,
right?
So I mean, are an important aspect of that.
I mean, I'm just looking at WTI crude oil, or actually Brent crude. We're down to 86. We were up to close over 90 here. So how do you factor that in, what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in the Middle East? We passed another bill for also to fund some issues in Taiwan. How does that factor into your research and kind of how you view kind of rates, how you view currencies?
Yeah, let me say that a lot of economists tend to discount the importance of oil prices in the overall inflation picture and in respect to the Fed's policy outlook. And the reason for that is also simple. It's not part of core inflation. We like to think of energy and the energy complex as sitting outside of core. And we like to think that when oil prices go up, it's going to be temporary, in part because it is a supply side shock that drives these prices from time to time. I tend to fight against that view. And here's the reason. If you are a labor union and you're sitting in front of your employer and you're demanding higher wages, you're not going to say, I don't eat food and I don't consume energy, you're going to say, I want my wage increase based on the basket that I consume. And that basket, very much for the average worker in the United States, is energy intensive and is food intensive. So even though core may be a better reflection of underlying inflation, when headline goes up, you have to imagine that workers are going to pressure their employers for higher wages. Okay. And to the extent that wages cause inflation, that in itself becomes inflationary.
The heritage of what you're hearing there, folks, this is critical, the path here. There was a guy named Lawrence Kudlow million years ago, before he was a ginormous TV star. I love busting Larry's chops. And he held court at Bear Stearns, and people threw apples and rocks at him because he was working in the nominal space. And then Malpass in Writing, in Weissman, they were working in the nominal. They had respect for the nominal space besides the convenience and crutch of real. Right now, do we underemphasize the nominal space and the persistency of a higher nominal GDP?
No, I actually don't think we do. To the extent that we are, that the world central banks are inflation targeters, it implies that they are very much looking at the nominal space. Now, if nominal GDP were to rally a lot and real GDP were not to rally a lot, you'd effectively have what is called an inflation problem, presumably driven by a supply side shock. You could make a case that the central bank should not respond to a supply side driven increase in inflation to the same extent that they would a real demand. Positive demand shock increase that causes inflation. But that's exactly the point that I was trying to contest earlier. And the reason is because inflation expectations matter. At least the conventional wisdom is that they do.
What are they
and certainly central
right,
banks believe that they do.
What does inflation expectations, the synthesis of that, tell you right now?
That they're not high enough to cause panic at the Fed, but there is this risk that if oil prices stay high indefinitely because of these issues regarding supply side shocks, the war, climate change, demography, et cetera, even deglobalization, that they may at some point start to drift higher.
I could be a currency trader. I'm just long the dollar. Give me a bear case for the dollar. I mean, I could do this for a living.
So the bear case for the dollar, if there's a structural one, is that the dollar will no longer be at some point, and no one knows when, the world's reserve currency. Now, we are already seeing signs that this is manifest. We see,
really?
Of course, we see China accumulating gold. Well, that's telling you that they may not like the dollar anymore. We certainly see the Russians moving away from dollar reserves. We've seen the Venezuelans do that. Now, the bull case for the dollar as well, you can dismiss these countries because they're, you know, part of this, I don't want to say axis of evil,
obviously, but
they're not on the same side of the fence as the U.S. But to the extent that we get a bipolarity in this world and we really get a true, a new Berlin Wall that goes up between the West and the rest, you have to imagine that that's going to be bad for the dollar because the dollar has benefited in this era of globalization. Anything that tends to reduce the amount of globalization tends to be bad for the dollar. And that new Berlin Wall would be bad for the dollar.
What are we going to see in GDP here in a couple of days? Does Macquarie have a view on U.S. GDP?
Yeah, it's going to stay robust. Do we have a pinpoint view on quarter one's? Yeah, on quarter one's results, I think we're at about 2.5%, if not mistaken, 2.4, 2.5 annualized.
But robust.
Yeah. And that's very close to consensus. If you look at some of these GDP Now estimates that come out of some of the reserve banks and the Fed, they're a little bit higher. And again, if it is going to be strong, it's going to be driven by consumption.
This was fabulous. Terry Weissman, thank you so much. And congratulations on a really thought-provoking note in your team on, it's just blunt, folks. Wars lead to inflation. If you're a senior consultant at Deloitte, that gives you a twisted perspective.
It does.
I mean, it's not like, you know,
explains a lot.
The CFA combine. It's not like, you know, you come out of King's College, you get some parchment, modern history in Oxford. That sets you up for the streaming wars. Why don't you bring in our next victim?
I tell you, one of the top media analysts in the City of London, covering all the European media sector for many years, is Ian Whittaker, managing director and owner of Liberty Sky Advisors. He's based in London, joining us here in New York City, doing a little tour here in the U.S. Ian, thanks so much for coming into our studio. We appreciate it. We had some really good numbers that blew Tom Keene and I away from Netflix. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this streaming business, Netflix can certainly make a lot of money. How about the other media companies, the Disneys, the Paramounts, the Tom's favorite, Warner Brothers, Discovery? what's happening in the streaming business?
So thanks very much, Tom, Paul, for having me. Thanks very much, Tom, as well. I think if you look at streaming, if you look at long-term view, it's absolutely right. Netflix's numbers on a Q1 basis, absolutely fantastic. Really hard to disagree with anything they did. I think if you actually look at sort of some of the underlying things sort of within there and some of the details and some things they didn't mention, big question marks. You take away, as has been mentioned, information on subscriber growth from 2025 onwards. True. What does that say? Games, that had been talked about as a big strategy sort of for them to grow revenues. Nothing on the call whatsoever in terms of that. And the games, you know, games industry is quite tough at the moment. Sports, you listen to what they're saying at the moment, definitely sounds as though there is a shift in terms of their strategy in sports, but they're going to have to spend big if they're going to do this. So there's a range of different questions, I think. The fundamental issue for the streaming business is this. What the big media companies have done, I think they replaced a model that worked extremely well with it for them for a number of years, and they sort of jumped into streaming into a business model that, quite frankly, is not sort of not great longer term. And I think we'll look back in probably 5 to 10 years' time and we'll say this would be one of those business case studies where people would say, why didn't the major media companies, the Disney's, the Warner's, etc., take a little bit more time before they jumped on the streaming bandwagon? Because if you look at it, streaming penetration here is flatlining in many countries. Yeah, I think fundamental mistake that the streaming executives made, particularly big media companies, was to treat the rest of the world as though it was the US in terms of the same dynamics. Absolutely not the case whatsoever, even in a market like Europe, which is quite similar, and so forth. And now you see all of them, what are they focusing on? Trying to reduce losses.
Yep.
Okay, well, that's great, but that's not a growth strategy moving forward. So I think if I look on a longer term basis, sure, there's a little bit of confidence for streaming, but longer term, I think it's the dynamic's still difficult.
So you look at a company like Paramount, for example, which back in the day, you and I recall when Paramount was a / Viacom / CBS was a great company, was a blue chip media company. They can't give themselves away these days. Yeah. I mean, what happens to a company like a Paramount as they try to navigate to this streaming world?
Well, I think, again, it sort of comes back to this point that for many of these companies, what they did was rush in. What they didn't think about was what exactly was the long game here. The smartest one, and this is not, this is something that's been said by others as well, but the smartest sort of company on the entertainment space was Sony. Because what it said was, you know what, we cannot compete in terms of being a mass market streaming player.
Right.
It actually makes sense for us to sell our content to other players. The arms dealer analogy that has been used multiple times as well. You look at someone like a Paramount, that's exactly what the strategy for somebody like a Paramount should be. Free cash flow generation is not that great. Sorry.
So, well, sell the book. I get it. Sell the catalog. I get it. But to me, there's a fundamental issue in the train wreck of Paul Sweeney's world. And that is the intangible assets and badwill on the balance sheets. These numbers are, in my amateur opinion, ginormous. Mm-hmm. Is the shock that's coming that they're going to have to adjust intangibles down?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And the answer is probably yes. The point being, I think if you were to ask all these streaming executives, all the top CEOs of these companies, the honest truth about where they think the streaming business would go, I think they fundamentally recognize that essentially the end game is not looking good. The problem becomes for many of them, in terms of their reputation, they've gone to the market and sold this sort of story for years. And I think many of them will find it very difficult to actually step out of that. That's going to be really the big issue. I think what will happen is that you'll get a continuation of the story, people saying, look, there's growth coming over the next 3 to 5 years. But at some point, these companies are going to have to bite the bullet.
Now, are you in New York on your way to LA to help close the Paramount deal? Is there can we make some news today?
I'm always available for. Quite happy to go there. Yeah.
Talk to us about the global advertising business. I know you have a lot of experience with the big ad agencies in London, in New York here. Mm-hmm. Is the money still going to broadcast and cable television, or is it just going to the Metas of the world and the Googles of the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting dynamics that you've got with advertising at the moment. So if you take the advertising industry generally in terms of ad spend, you know, what we'd say is that you've seen the advertising market perform much better than expected over the past couple of years. And I think what you've had here is a vast and planned experiment over the past 2 years where companies were able to pull up their prices much more aggressively to consumers than they thought. And if you listen to the conference calls from those companies, they will say probably the key reason they were able to do that was the strength of the brand. And so I think fundamentally, there is a sort of realization that advertising works. Then the question mark becomes, where exactly is that money going to? And you know, what is interesting here when you look at the numbers in terms of each, so that you look at the broadcasters had a tough 2023, 2024, you know, the question marks, actually in Europe, it started off relatively okay for the broadcasters and so forth. Is money going to the online platforms? You're starting to see the growth rate slow. Now, if you take Facebook last year, everyone said revenue numbers absolutely fantastic, you know, great growth and so forth. That was driven by advertising revenues coming from Asia Pac advertisers. You look at it, it was up 30% sort of 2023, nearly double the revenue growth. If you look for North American advertisers, their spend on Facebook was only up single digits. So I think, you know, one of the big questions we're going to have over the next, let's say, 2 to 3, 4 years is, you've got these platforms where there's increasingly question marks from the established markets as to whether money should be going into there. But where does that money go in future? Retail media, you know, does it go to some other segments that come up at the moment?
Right, we're out of time. Ian, don't be a stranger. Ian Whitaker with us, with Liberty Sky Advisors as well.
He's just been to the net a few times.
Did you work with Jessica Reif Cohen? Were you on the same watch with Jessica Reif Cohen, Merrill?
In the London team, yeah. Back in the early 2000s.
Very cool. Ian, thank you. So I'd love to get you on with Jessica Reif Cohen. Your daily look at the front pages around the world, our most popular segment, Lisa Mateo.
So we've been talking about all different things that New Yorkers are, that concern New Yorkers, right? We talked about congestion pricing, hot button issue. The other one, it's the one Michael Barr's been talking about. A lot of the protests going on over the Israel-Gaza war. They're starting to ramp up. You heard him talk about Columbia University. They canceled in-person classes. Police, they've arrested a dozen protesters at Yale, New York University. And the college leaders are in their spot. They're being called out for whether they're doing enough to protect students, faculty, staff. And at the same time, they're being criticized for denying students right to speak out. So they're in this weird position. Already, you had more than 100 demonstrators arrested at Columbia last night, more arrests at NYU. I mean, it's spreading to different universities. You have Boston University, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, MIT, the University of California at Berkeley. So this is a growing issue.
There's a lot of other schools. You know, there's somebody out on Twitter was saying, yep, but then there's Chicago, or then there's Duke. Paul, you just visited at Duke, and every school is dealing with this in an original way. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I think most schools are just trying their best, I guess, to kind of protect free speech of what they're certainly all about, while also, you know, protecting their students. All I can say is that, boy, if I were paying $100,000 to Columbia to send my kid there, I'm not sure I'd want them in virtual classes. I don't know. That's a tough situation there.
Well, I'm not going to go there. It's not our job, my job, I should say, to comment on the micro policy of different school. I would say, Lisa, a few, it's like the Fed minutes, several, some of us, a few of us have a nodding acquaintance with 1968. And then the tension was a war, Vietnam War. And there was also a huge undercurrent of a racial tension as well. And to me, and I'm speaking strictly as an amateur, to me, there's a huge distinction between what we're seeing right now and what we lived in 1968. I happened to be in Paris in 1968 in that complete ferment as a child. And I really need to read on this from experts, including from Bloomberg Opinion, about the compare contrast with 1968, because I don't really see it right now. I'd love to read more on that. What else do you have?
Sure. But so before kids get to college, they have to get through elementary and middle school and high school. Schools are banning cell phones, but parents, they're kind of getting in the way of it. So this is the big battle. So moms and dads say they want the kids to keep the cell phone because they want them in case of emergency. Times are different now. I mean, kids are having, you know, not shooting drills, you know, in schools. But the teachers are saying that it's taking away from focus. It's taking away from their education time because that's part of their job now to kind of monitor what kids are using these cell phones. So this is becoming the issue. There was a school district in Colorado tried to ban it. Parents got on the away. So they came up with a compromise where the kids could hold it. They do this at my daughter's school. They can hold the phone, but they can't take them out until like recess or lunch.
Okay.
But it's different in every school.
My kids, they're mid to late 20s when they got to sixth grade. That was when we would consider it.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Can I do an addendum to this?
Yes.
Vince Farrell, one of the giants of equity analysis. We lost him way too young. I'm still in such sadness over the death of Vince Farrell. He and I sat in tears one day laughing in the room right next door where we invented this. And Vince Farrell and I were trying to outdo each other on when do you stop paying your kids' cell phone bills.
This is the
come on, Lisa. When do you stop paying the kids' damn cell phone bills?
I don't know. Ask my
21-year-old. 9 years old or 12.
This is the last. I've cut my kids. They're off.
They are off? I was going to ask.
Except for the phone. That's the last
thing. That's it. Good morning to the memory of Vince Farrell.
Exactly.
Vince Farrell went to his grave paying like six kids' cell phone bills.
Exactly.
What do you got, Lisa?
That's an issue. I'm telling my sister, I think it's when she got married, my parents finally cut her off of the family plan. All right, so we're going back to, this was a yesterday story. I want to point it out. How the FTC is suing to block that $8.5 billion union of Coach for Tapestry. So Tapestry is trying to take over Capri Holdings. $8.5 billion. So it's the first time the kind of Biden administration is stepping into for a deal in the fashion accessories industry. That's why it makes it interesting. But you have Tapestry, okay? They own Coach, Kate Spade, George Weitzman.
Okay, so what?
Exactly. Who cares?
They have, you know, Michael Kors, Versace, Jimmy Choo.
Oh, Jimmy Choo. Okay.
Yes,
they have James Choo.
They do.
Did you notice they just moved their store? I saw you in there looking at the...
I can't tell my secrets. But it's the problem that the enforcers are saying that it's going to deal to price rate. They're saying the prices are going to start to rise if these two companies merge. They're saying workers' wages are going to be affected because the companies compete, you know, for competition for workers.
I tell you, this administration is tough
it's getting tough.
If I'm an M&A lawyer, I'm like, I'm not sure I can advise you guys. Yeah. We can get anything done these days.
Next.
Yes, it's a tough one. All right. If you've been online, right, to go shopping or whatever you do, and sometimes that notice pops up like, okay, find out how many motorcycles how many bridges.
Exactly.
You know, they're called CAPTCHAs.
I failed those quite a lot.
That's the problem, okay? They're preventing bots from, you know, disrupting websites, but a lot of people are saying that they're starting to get a little bit more difficult.
Yeah,
and they are because they're the people who make them, they're trying to have to go after these bad actors who are figuring out how to crack them. So now they're getting even tougher to do. So I know I failed.
Yes.
I failed the motorcycle one. I was like, wait, that's a wait. You know, it gets a little confusing. And so they're going to be just the warning out there. They're going to be getting a little bit more difficult. So if you're thinking caps on when you go shop online or shop anywhere else, they're going to start to get a little bit harder.
Lisa Mateo, thank you so much. The newspapers today. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.